The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 423, post storm edition, for Sunday, November 4th, 2012.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, we provide some answers, you send in your tips. We provide some tips of our own. Together, we like to share something we call cool stuff found. And we all come here to learn at least a little something new each and every time we get together here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, assuming that you didn't take a little nap before the show started. Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, emerging from the chaos, John F. Braun.
That's right. And I would like to say hi to everybody, of course, that's joining us in the chat room tonight. We have a full chat room, which is really nice to see on a Sunday evening here.
How can it ever really be full, though, Dave?
Well, it's not. That's right. It's
virtually it's infinite.
It's well populated is what I would like to say.
Yes, it is. Yeah, 25. That is. I think that may be a record.
It might be. Yeah. MacGeekGab.com/stream is where you would do that. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook if you want to join us there. But of course, you don't have to. You can get everything you would like out of the show right here listening just as you are, however you are. And yes, both John Moore than I survived the or endured, I should say. We both survived equally well. But John endured more of the effects of this particular storm than I did. I lost power for about 20 hours. And John, you lost it for 6 days, if my math is right.
Yes, it started Monday p.m. Mm-hmm. For most people, that's when our power went out and came back. I would say Saturday afternoon. Saturday. Yes.
I'll keep track of it for you, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, after a while, you just lose track of time, Dave.
Trust me. I know. Listen, and we'll talk. We're going to do a segment toward the end of the show about how we prepared ahead of time. And then, of course, how we both endured the various power outages that we had. But, you know, for us, John, it was really, really weird because here as longtime listeners of the show, or even, you know, not that longtime listeners will know, when we lose power here, it is many, many days. Oftentimes, you know, we've had it for more than a week where it goes out. And we're not in the middle of nowhere here. It's just that we're in New Hampshire.
Yes, you are.
All the lines are above ground. No,
yes,
we're really
you are.
Not
in the middle of nowhere. Relatively speaking, well, no, you are certainly less densely populated than I am, I would say.
At least my
neck of the woods.
Yeah. But you know,
you're in a college town. So yeah, it's not, you know, totally off the map.
No, and we're 10 minutes from Portsmouth and whatever. But anyway, in New Hampshire, the power just goes out for a really long time because all the lines are above ground. So and I think they keep it that way because then they get all the FEMA funds to repair the lines when they go down, as opposed to if they wanted to bury them now, then they'd have to do that out of their own budget. So anyway, but that's my tinfoil hat conspiracy theory about what the power companies do.
Awesome.
Anyway, when the power goes out, so we had one night, we had Monday night where it was out, and then it was back on, you know, Tuesday afternoon. So there was Tuesday night and we were all in this really weird funk. It was like, we didn't know what to do. We had all clearly gone through some level of mental preparation for being out for many days. It was like Tuesday night. We're like, well, yeah, I guess we just cooked dinner. You know, we were really thrown off our game. But anyway, we were not unhappy. It was just odd. But as I was prepping the show this week, of course, I had to do the lion's share of the show prep simply because John was off the, grid. Yeah, sure. And I realized we could do something that would be a good thing for us to do. And that is, I picked topics. Now, in a general sense, this won't be true, but certainly for the specifics, I picked topics that I don't believe we have ever covered in the 422 shows prior. So this should, in theory, be all new ground. Now, we may venture into revisited ground, but the goal, and at least the agenda, has us on all new ground. So it should be mostly new ground. And with that, let's go to Dave, who says, my question pertains to the MacBook Pro 15-inch Retina in clamshell mode. I have a 27-inch Thunderbolt monitor to which it is connected. How does this affect the battery life and performance? Keep in mind, I rarely disconnect it, and I do put it to sleep as much as possible because I'm unable to boot up in the clamshell mode. Thanks, and I look forward to your response. Yeah, so clamshell mode, for those of you that either don't know or haven't figured it out, is when you have an external monitor, external keyboard, external mouse connected to a Mac laptop, and the laptop operates closed, simply acting like a Mac Mini or, you know, even a Mac Pro, in the sense that it is just the guts sort of driving all of these external devices.
And Apple, so the only difference is, as far as I could tell, is you are not using your built-in display. But other than that, the machine is operating, as you said, kind of like a Mac Mini or a headless Mac, if you will.
You're right. Exactly. Well, but it's not headless because you've plugged a monitor in, right? But yeah, it's running. Yes.
Or headless. When I say headless, I mean that you're not using the built-in display, or you're right, using a external or third-party display rather than the built-in display. But other than that, yeah, it should be identical.
And it is okay to do. All Mac laptops are built to run in clamshell mode. So in terms of heat dissipation and all of that stuff, you know, it is going to run a little hotter because it's, you know, that's how it is, but it is built to dissipate enough heat. And so you should be okay in that regard. And it really shouldn't, clamshell mode all by itself shouldn't have any notable impact on the life of your battery. However, because you are running in clamshell mode, by definition, you are most likely tethered to a desk because you've got this other monitor and potentially a wired keyboard and mouse, though they could be wireless. But the monitor, as you said, is wired via Thunderbolt. So chances are you also have it plugged into power. And if you run your Mac laptop plugged into power all of the time, or even most of the time, the longevity of your battery will be greatly diminished. So you want to remember to unplug it regularly, and run it through, you know, really the idea behind the battery, if you can keep one concept in mind, it is keep the electrons flowing either into the battery or out of the battery, but don't leave them in stasis, meaning sitting at 100% all the time with the power plugged in. So if you can do that, that's great. One of our friends, Jeff Lynch, developed Fruit Juice, which is an app for helping you maintain and monitor your battery. Fruitjuiceapp.com would be a good place to visit if you know that you're going to leave your Mac plugged in all the time. It will remind you about various things that are valuable to you. So any other thoughts on
nice.
That?
Yeah. Well, Fruit Juice, well, he's got the juice, obviously.
He's got the juice. That's right.
But we will link to. So I found an article. You may ask yourself, has Apple made any sort of official commentary on this? And yes, they have. And there's a knowledge base article, HT3131, which is nice and symmetrical. In a sense, Mac notebooks, how to use your computer in closed clamshell paren display closed close paren mode with an external display. So Apple does. Yeah. As you're saying here, they have a few caveats here mentioning what you should expect when you're trying to do this sort of thing.
Yep. All right. So there's clamshell mode. And we started with Dave. And so we will go to David. And he asks something that, yes, is certainly something we talk about a lot, but we haven't ever actually answered this particular question. He says, I am looking for some help and feedback on how to use Onyx. I hear you guys mention it all the time, but I'm not quite sure what I should be running and how I should be doing it. I've been using Mac since Tiger was released, and I'm pretty familiar with the OS. I currently have a late 2009 27-inch iMac with Mountain Lion. It's starting to get a little sluggish, and I decided to download Onyx to do some preventative maintenance and cleanup. I have downloaded and installed the latest version and now have some questions about how to configure it and what are the best settings. Do you recommend the use of Onyx for occasional maintenance? Yes, we do. What is the difference between the titanium products Onyx and maintenance? We'll talk about that. Do they do different things, or is maintenance a subset product of Onyx? Should I run Onyx with the default settings? How should I do it? And should I use automatic mode? So, yeah, near as I can tell, maintenance is a subset of Onyx, and there's no reason not to download Onyx because they're both the same price, which is free. As far as running Onyx, I do it with the automation section. And the defaults there are fine, but I do add three things to the defaults when I'm running Onyx. By default, the three that I add, and then we'll talk about what all are on, but the three I'm adding are execute maintenance scripts, rebuild spotlight index, and rebuild mail index, which means that the following things are not on. You're not rebuilding the display of folders content. You're not erasing the web browser cache and history, and you're not automatically removing saved versions of the documents. These are things that I think you might actually want to have long-term. They're certainly things I want to have long-term. So I don't have Onyx erase those, but everything else I do. My guess is the reason that they do not include the maintenance scripts and the mail index and the spotlight index is because those things take a longer time to run than the rest of the stuff that that Onyx is going to do. So, but that's what I do. I go to the automation tab. I make sure the options are set that way. I click execute, it runs, and then when it finishes, it says it wants to reboot. So I quit all my apps first because I know I'm going to reboot at the end anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's how I run Onyx. And hopefully that helps somebody else out there too. It's good stuff, right?
Cool. That's not typically how I run it, though. I would say that. Well, I would say that when I go into Onyx, I typically go in there for a. It's usually because something's wrong.
Okay.
So I typically don't go in there just to go in there and run Onyx. Though it is a nice app, and you know, it looks nice, visually pleasing. But typically, I'll go in there, Dave, when something starts to go wrong. And typically, I will go into the. Which is right near the automation section, but typically I'll go and part of what it runs, but the cleaning section I would say is almost always where I go when I do go in Onyx, because there's something wrong and I figure, you know what, there's some cache or some, for the most part, a cache or something else there that I figure, you know what, it couldn't hurt if the system rebuilds this because something's going wrong. And so that's my typical usage, but
yeah.
And as you point out, it does touch on things that should happen on a normal basis, like, you know, especially the Unix cleanup scripts. You know, there's daily, weekly, and monthly.
Right.
You can certainly have it kick those off for you or tell you when they have run last. But just let it toss it in. That's my latest. But, I got to say, Dave, for the most part, the problems that you and I have seen, I would say, at least for me, dirty caches.
Yeah.
Or a cache being something that's stored from an earlier point in time and is there to hopefully speed things up. And as long as the data that you're retrieving hasn't been updated, that's exactly what a cache is supposed to do. It's supposed to store data and make it quicker to retrieve than having to do it again from the internets.
That's right.
And for the most part, again, that's what I found it usually helps, is that for whatever reason, the cache hasn't got deleted or it's in a confused state or it's corrupt and things go haywire. That's my typical use case.
Yeah. So. Cool. All right. Moving on to Francis. He says, I was having a problem with Safari the other day. And what was happening was I got a notification that said Safari can't verify the identity of the website, and then gave him the name of a website. And he says, what does this mean? And the message goes on to say the certificate for this website is invalid. You might be connecting to a website that's pretending to be what you think you're connecting to. Why is this happening? And he says, and then we got another email from Francis before we got a chance to get back. And he says, now the problem's gone. It's not happening anymore. So when you connect to a secure website, the website issues a certificate to you, and then you encrypt data with that and send it back to the website. Even if you get a notification that says this certificate can't be verified, the data that you're sending to the website is still being encrypted. The issue is you're encrypting it with a certificate that may or may not have been compromised. And really what's happening is it's saying, look, we don't have a Safari is telling you Safari comes with a bunch of default certificates, and then you can sort of build on those. Which means that, you know, like for us, if you want to get a premium subscription, you know, you're going to enter some data that may be interesting to nefarious folks. And so we have a secure certificate there. and we send you our certificate, but ours is built on a series of certificates that go back to one that Safari has built into it. And that way Safari knows, yeah, I can follow the chain of this through to something I know to be trusted. And therefore I'm going to trust this. And you don't get a warning when you come to our site. But if we had generated our certificate ourselves, you would get a warning saying, hey, look, these guys may or may not be who they say they are. You get to decide whether or not you want to trust them. But if you do decide to trust them, we're going to go ahead and encrypt your data with this. So it's not like the data is not being encrypted. It's just that Safari can't necessarily trust the person and has to rely on you to decide whether or not you want to trust this website. And you can get this message even with sites that have valid certificates if something in the chain is just not working right at that point in time. Maybe a server's down or something that doesn't let the validation happen, which is probably what happened with Francis, because it then just started working again several days later. So that's what's going on with these certificates, but it's always going to be encrypted. You just don't know who has access to the keys to unlock the encryption if Safari gives you that warning message. Is that, I know I translated that into human language, John. Did I miss anything there?
I could understand it.
Okay. Well, that's
what,
one.
What I'll say, though, so to crystallize what you said, I mean, what happens is when you go to a secure website, what happens basically is that, as you stated, but to, you know, focus on this, is that the certificates that is being presented to you by a website is checked against a list of known good certificate issuers, which is stored on your Mac, and that is built into the OS and installed when you install the OS. And it may get updated from time to time when these guys come up with new certificates. Though, you know, Dave, this is interesting because I've seen this happen before, and the specific error message actually says, so the first thing it says is, oh, well, you know, let me tell you about the person that I don't trust here. And in this one, it's GTE Cyber Trust Global Root, which GTE has been doing, you know, internet stuff for years.
Sure.
So you certainly trust them. But where I think the problem here is what, where actually the certificate ran into a problem was that it was a, and this is very timely, and maybe this is why you put it together this way. I think this is a caching issue of sorts, because it says, oh, well, I don't like this certificate. It belongs to Akamai.net. Now, Akamai, if you folks don't know, is a, and I'm sure you've dealt with them, Dave, or, sure, or have had to. Now, they should be transparent, but Akamai, I think what they do is they are a company that will help distribute your content or cache your content so that people can retrieve it quicker.
Well, they're a lot like, we use a service called Cachefly, right?
Right.
And
they do the same thing, I think.
Very similar to Onyx.
Our content get to people quicker, to right?
Yeah, it stores copies. In our case, what happens is we upload the MP3 or the AAC for the show to Cachefly to one place. And then they have servers all over the world, and they go and put the same copy of that data file out on all of their servers. So when you go to connect, it says, wait, where are you? And it directs you to the server closest to you and then beams you the file. And Akamai does exactly the same thing. So, yeah. So, but, you know, in theory, every one of their edge servers has the same version of the file, but it's possible that something could get out of whack when you get lots and lots of edge servers happening out there. And that.
Right. Yep. So in this case, I think what happened is whatever cached the certificate portion of the communication got, I don't know how we can put this technically, munched.
Yeah, there you go. I'll go with that.
So that's why you, so although everything else worked, apparently, yeah, whatever version of the certificate that they had cached was old or corrupted or something, and that's why you got this error. Though everything else seemed to work just fine, which is good.
That's good. Right. Oh, that's good. Before we move on to Robert's question, I want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Smile Software. And they are the makers of lots of great apps, including PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. PDF Pen is a fantastic utility for modifying, creating, and simply using PDFs. PDFs have become such a huge part of our computing and data sharing environment. I mean, we see contracts using PDFs. We see information, you know, you're getting documentation from, you know, I have documentation files for my dishwasher in PDF. And it's actually pretty awesome because I can store them all in a folder on my computer and I don't have to dig through a big box of stupid manuals when I need to find my dishwasher. But, you know, sometimes there's stuff you want to do with a PDF. And if it's a contract, you might want to put your signature on it, right? Well, PDF Pen lets you edit the PDF and actually place an image or even draw your signature right there on the PDF. You can also place text from that you type in and position that all over it, almost treating your PDF like the background to a page layout document. And of course, if it's your dishwasher, you might remember, so you might say, hey, this is the thing we fixed on, you know, I used this section of the manual in January of 2012 to fix that thing with the, you know, the food grinder. And so you might want to put a little note in there that you did that. Well, PDF Pen lets you do that too. You totally can customize stuff. You can remove pages. You can add pages. You can even edit the text that's in a PDF by highlighting it. And they've got a little text edit button that lets you totally go in there and change what's on a PDF. So now we're not even using it as a background for what we're drawing on it, but we're actually changing the page. And really, really cool stuff. If you get PDF Pen Pro, if you need to create PDFs that have, you know, those cool forms that you need to fill, you know, sometimes you go to fill out a form and if the PDF opens in your browser or in preview or whatever, and you've got little forms that you can type into, you can create those forms with PDF Pen Pro. So if you have a need to do that, go check that out. Go check it out, though, smilesoftware.com, and you can download PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro for your Mac there. Of course, they also, as you may have heard, have PDF Pen for the iPad and the iPhone now, allowing you to do all the same things that we're talking about here on your Mac. So check it out. This is one of those pieces of software that's easy for me to talk about. I really love having Smile as a sponsor because I use this almost every day when I'm at my desk. There's just because PDFs are such a huge part of what we do. It's, you know, I if I don't have PDF Pen on my Mac, it becomes painfully obvious to me very, very quickly, and I have to remedy it right away. So you go remedy it right away too. Go to smilesoftware.com. You can download a 30-day trial and check it out. And then when you're ready to roll, you go buy it. PDF Pen Pro is $99.95. That gives you the extra creation features. PDF Pen is $59.95, but go check out the free trial first. Make sure you know why you're going to go spend that 60 or 100 bucks and then go do it. Smilesoftware.com. I heard you, did you have something to say about PDF Pen while I was doing that, John, or were you just getting ready for the next question?
I was just raring to go.
Raring to go is good. Robert asks, I love the idea of Apple's new Fusion Drive, which uses software in Mountain Lion to administer data between SSD and spindle drives. It seems to be baked into the operating system, not into the drives. And since I already have both of these kinds of drives running on my Mac, I wonder if I can use Mountain Lion's Fusion software's controls without having to buy the Apple Fusion Drive. The answer actually came to us from Michael Johnston, who is the one that converts this show to AAC and adds all the chapters and all of that stuff. After hearing the last show where we talked about this, he found the solution, and someone has figured out how to use core storage to create a Fusion Drive, and they posted a all the instructions up there. So yes, it is totally doable. However, I have to mention that if you're going to do this with your boot drive, you need to assume that if there are any problems that you would need to fix with, you know, a recovery partition or with, you know, a DVD or whatever, you know, some external boot drive, assume that because this is an unsupported configuration of Fusion Drive, and you're not even tricking the OS into creating what it calls a Fusion Drive for you. You are talking directly to core storage and just telling it, create this thing. And I'm sure it's the same as what Apple's doing, but I don't expect Apple's utilities to say, hey, you've got a Fusion Drive. I know just what to do. My guess is it's going to be, yeah, you've got something going on there, dude. And I'm assuming since you created it, you know how to fix it. So make sure you have really good backups, because I don't expect any of the utilities that Apple presents us with to be able to, or to be forthcoming with fixes for this. So if you're comfortable with that, then yeah, you know, we'll put the link. I put the link in the chat room for everybody listening on the stream. And of course we'll put it in the show notes for those of you listening at home or in your cars or wherever it is you would choose to listen. So
on the one hand, Dave, I like the hacky goodness
of course
being able to do this. On the other hand, as you were suggesting, I think, oh gosh, make a backup of everything if you do this, because you're on very thin ice here by trying to trick Apple's OS into doing what it normally doesn't want to do, you're trying to trick it.
To be fair, though, it like I said, it's not like you're going and changing some plist that makes the Mac think, oh, hey, I can create a Fusion drive here. All of this functionality is built into core storage. You are creating an LVM volume using the logical volume manager. And so it's hacky in that you're sort of creating it on your own, but you're not tricking the OS into doing anything it wouldn't normally do. You could have done this 3 months ago. Nothing has changed, right? So and people probably have been doing this for a while. So it's not like you're tricking like in the sense that we used to be able to say, oh yeah, we're going to trick, you know, your older Mac to let it run Mountain Lion, right? That's one sort of, that's like real trickery where you're, you know,
well, leading, you know, that one is a different thing in that it's putting a block in place because it doesn't feel that certain parts of your system have the performance necessary for a pleasant user experience. So they say, all right, if you're below this threshold as far as horsepower of your hardware, I'm not going to install.
Right.
Of course, if you want to change this internal check, and I think basically the strategy is you monkey with or delete a plist file that it checks for this sort of thing, then it'll just happily march ahead.
Right.
And you'll suffer the consequences.
Right.
Whatever they'll be, which probably will be, the system will be sluggish in certain places. And you know, if it's that versus not being able to run the OS that you so desperately want to run, then okay.
Yeah.
Maybe able to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Yeah. So it's all there. It just as it would have been if you did this 3 months ago, don't expect Apple to support it. Just because now newer machines have this thing that they call Fusion Drive, which is very similar to the end result of what you're creating on your own, you know, So off you go. It is supported in the OS. My guess is, like, especially with Fusion Drive there, it will be supported in future versions of the OS. So it's safe to do in that I don't think the functionality is going to go away, but don't expect Apple's utilities to treat you to coddle you as they do when you're doing stuff that's sort of in their box. My guess is, though, that we will see Fusion Drives available for older Macs probably in like 6 months, right? When this becomes like a normal thing, and it'll just be one of those things. It's like, yeah, go ahead and create one. It's fine.
Well, I think it'll be similar to Trim. And right now you can certainly hack the OS to support Trim on I think officially now the position is still, all right, we'll support Trim, which is a mechanism to get better write efficiency.
Right.
If you want to boil it down, out of an SSD. But right now, as far as I know, Dave, unless they change something in Mountain Lion, it will only work on Apple branded SSDs. You can certainly monkey with the OS and say, oh, by the way, you know, ignore that and just implement it on the drive I have now, which I'm going to tell you it's OK to do this and please do it. And I've done it. I've done the hack. I think it actually plays with a kernel extension file. And eliminates a check saying, oh, by the way, are you an Apple SSD? Yeah. Okay.
Right. Right. Yeah. All right. Let's go to Andrew here. This is, this is one that Andrew actually solved on his own with some help from the manufacturer, but it's a really good thing. There's a lesson here. So bear with us.
And g'day, John. G'day, Dave. It's Andrew here on Australia's Gold Coast. I've got a problem connecting a external USB drive to my Time Capsule. So I've got the latest version of Time Capsule, and I want to plug in my G-Tech mini drive into the back of that. but it doesn't show up when I plug it in. It doesn't show up as a drive in the airport utility, nor does it show up as a shared drive in Finder. Now, it's formatted in Apple extended journaled. I've also plugged in a little USB thumb drive, and it shows up as a disk drive as well as in the airport utility. But no matter what I do, this GTEC mini USB drive just won't show up on the airport utility or on my computer via USB into the back of the time capsule. It works fine going straight into my MacBook. Anyway, so I wrote to GTEC or Hitachi and said, dude, what's doing? And they wrote back and said, oh, we don't know. We can't work it out. There's some compatibility issue. And here's a reference to an Apple forum. Go and work it out for yourself. So they immediately got a fist shake from me. So anyway, I've read what they've suggested. It is absolutely gobbledygook to me. I forwarded it to you guys as well. Help, can you have a look at this for me and offer any advice? And if you do find something, don't get caught. See ya. Bye.
Thanks, Andrew. All right. So we went round and round about a couple of things, and the drive should work if it's formatted right. It does need to be formatted correctly. It needs to be HFS plus, and it needs to be, I believe, GUID partition table. But none of that mattered for him. He wound up getting another tech on, and talked through them. And interestingly, his Mac would. This is a USB drive. And a FireWire drive. His Mac would power it just fine over FireWire. But remember, the time capsule is USB. And he had asked the first tech about this, who said it didn't matter. But it turns out the issue is that the time capsule does not have enough juice to bus power this drive over USB. He hooked up a 12-volt power adapter to it to provide the drive its own power separate from the bus. And everything worked out fine. So the lesson here, which I really didn't know, is that the time capsule does not provide enough power, at least for some drives. I'm sure there are some drives that it will power just fine, but don't expect it to be able to power everything. A corollary to that is that USB and FireWire are very different. FireWire is really built to provide more power over the bus, more consistent power over the bus than USB ever was, at least for hard drives especially. So that's my story, John.
And I suppose thank you're sticking to it.
I'm stuck to it. Yeah, I'm committed now. That's right.
You know, that is a very interesting, I would say, oversight, because as far as I know, Dave, although on the Mac you can certainly run system info or system profile or whatever they call it this week, it will tell you, among the other things, it will tell you in the hardware section, specifically in the USB section, one of the parameters that is used to describe the behavior of a USB port is, oh, by the way, here's how much current, which boils down to power, because of course power is current times voltage, but it typically advertises the current that is available on that port. And normally the OS itself will yell at you if you try to plug something in that wants more.
Mm. That's right.
So there's two parts of it, is that the device itself has a built-in, and I think it's typically for most normal USB ports, 500 milliamps is normally the amount of current that it can support on its own without being externally powered. Anything more than that, and many of you may have seen this, I still see this sometimes, especially if you try to plug into like one of Apple's older keyboards, which has kind of a wimpy hub in it as far as power requirements. This is when I've almost always seen this message. When I do see it is when I plug something in the keyboard hub from an Apple keyboard, it'll be like, I don't have enough power for this.
So, yeah.
Please unplug this because I can't talk to it. So, but it's interesting because apparently, it kind of makes sense. There's no mechanism for the device itself to tell you of this.
Sure.
It may want to. And I wonder if it is somehow trying to desperately, if there's a log or something or a blinking light or something. No, I guess not. No, I guess it just doesn't work.
Yeah. So I would say, as a general rule of thumb, don't rely on bus power for any drives that you are connecting to a time capsule or, airport extreme. I would, you know, make sure they have their own wall wart outlets that, you know, well, really, I mean, you know, get them their own power. Do not rely.
Well, I like your use of that terminology. I don't think I've heard you say that in a while.
What's
wall
that?
Wart.
Oh yeah.
Wall
yeah.
wart.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but yeah, they, you know, it because simply because it may work right out of the gate, but as you pointed out, John, there is no way for you to get an error message from the time capsule that says, hey, I can't provide enough power. This is asking for more power than I want to give it. And so assume that it will happen at some point and get yourself a power adapter, which, you know, like I said, most likely ends up being a wall wart and chewing up, you know, valuable outlet mm-hmm. space. So,
and that's the thing that I always liked about FireWire. FireWire, if nothing else, was built to give you the juice. You know? Mm-hmm.
Well,
USB, typically, I've never seen a situation where a FireWire port did not provide enough power, but I've certainly seen it like this, where a USB port did not provide enough power for a single device.
Yep. And Kiwi Graham in the chat room has suggested perhaps using a powered hub. And that's certainly one way to go, connecting your time capsule or Airport Extreme to a hub that has its own power, and then you connect your devices to it. But even then, you'll never get an error message if it's asking for more than the hub is even providing. So, and it may be that this particular drive model isn't built to be USB bus powered, right? It's built to be FireWire bus powered, but that does not necessarily mean that it's built to be USB bus powered. So you've got to, you know, you got to sort of factor that into. All right. Ulysses writes, he says, the latest Mountain Lion update has introduced a major flaw with wireless networks. When Mountain Lion goes to sleep, it disconnects me from the wireless network. Normally, my MacBook Pro runs on the power adapter. It does not matter the power setting. It appears in Mountain Lion shutdown and upon waking restores the wireless network and my network shares, which is very annoying. I own a Synology NAS, and with the latest update, resetting the router is required so Mountain Lion can find the NAS device. Any help? So the interesting thing was this took an interesting turn. We had him go in and check settings in the energy saver, enabling Wi-Fi wake from sleep, which I thought would keep the Wi-Fi circuitry active. Even while the Mac was asleep, that didn't help. In the interim, he wound up calling AppleCare, and AppleCare suggested two things. One was resetting the power management on the machine, and then the other was deleting all of the Energy Saver plist files in the system preferences, or in the home library preferences folder, I believe is where those are stored. And he said one of those two things worked. But he did them both at the same time, so he doesn't know which it was. My guess is it was the SMC reset, though, because this seems like a far more, you know, SMC is one of those things that fixes hardware problems that aren't quite hardware, but sort of hardware. And so that's my guess on this one, but the plist files might also be it. But an SMC reset hopefully is the solution when you have Wi-Fi that won't stay working. Anything to add there, John?
Really?
Well, that's my theory.
Oh, I'm with you, brother.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There's that. I was just thinking, you know, should we call it hardware or software?
Well, that's
in my
the
world,
thing.
There's an ongoing battle between the forces of good, which in my opinion are the forces of software, and the forces of evil, which are the forces of hardware. And no, I've just throughout my career, I've had battles because it's always fun to figure out, all right, who do we blame? Is it a bug in the software or a bug in the firmware or the hardware?
Right.
Which I lump firmware into the hardware side, although technically I think firmware is software that tells the hardware what to do.
Right.
But it's married to the hardware.
Well, and that's what we're talking about with the SMC, right? I mean, we're in that sort of murky middle ground there. So.
Yeah, or it's settings that sometimes get corrupted or just need to be flushed because something's wrong.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Got it.
All right. Let's see. How are we doing on time here? Because we've got lots of stuff to go through. All right, we're actually doing okay. We're moving.
Really?
All right.
Okay.
Larry.
I could do a Jack Bauer and say we're running out of time.
That's right. Okay. Larry writes, he says, my bookkeeper has been merrily using Mail on an iMac running Snow Leopard for some months without any problems. Then she started getting a dialogue the other day that says, you can't use this version of Mail with this version of Mac OS X. It can't be used on this version of Mac OS X. Try opening the version of Mail located in the applications folder on your computer. He says, being the obedient sort, I did what the OS told me and found that there were indeed multiple versions of the Mail application installed on the machine, as System Profiler, or as you pointed out, whatever it's called now, indicates. He says, I tried all four and they all produce the same dialog box and they're all listed as the same version. So what might have happened to trigger this? The obvious thing that sticks out is I bought and installed a new printer, but I can't imagine that did it. I did uninstall the printer software, but Mail still doesn't run. I tried it on another user account on the same machine and got the same results. What do you think is happening? Well, what I think is happening is that there's some library file out there that is confusing the OS into thinking that whatever version of Mail is on there is not the one that it is expecting. The good news is you're running 10.6.8 version of Snow Leopard, and there is a combo updater out there. Mail was updated at some point along the path with Snow Leopard, and I think if you can reinstall Mail on there, this problem will go away. And I think the combo updater will do that. I don't think you have to go and reinstall from the Snow Leopard DVD. So go download the combo updater, which we'll put a link in the show notes for you. And it's going to be, you know, a little over a gigabyte. Run that on there. Hopefully that will put back in place whatever needs to happen. And then, yeah, get rid of all the other copies of Mail. Just have the one in the applications folder. There's no reason. I can't think of a reason to have multiple copies of Mail. The OS clearly doesn't want you to have them. It's not going to run older versions anyway. So get them out of there and then run this combo updater. And we're going to keep our fingers crossed for you because I think that'll do it. What do you think, John?
I think many things.
It's good. You're metacognitive. Not only do you think, you like to think about thinking. And I appreciate that about you. You didn't think I was going to pull that word out, did you?
I never know what to expect, even after all these years.
That's right.
So, now the only thing that occurs, yes, I would say that there is a likelihood that, yes, there is corruption at some level in the file system. Because letting it allow you to install multiple versions of an application, to me, means that it can't tell that it's already there. So is it a directory that's damaged, or I don't know, but... You know, that shouldn't happen.
Right.
Well, of course, many things that you ask us to help you with are things that shouldn't happen. Otherwise, right. You wouldn't call us.
That's what we're here for. Yeah.
And if you wanted to call us, well, we'll tell you in a moment. But first, I did want to take a little sideline here because there is a very, very nice tool that will help you do things like this. So typically, I would say the Apple installers do not give you the level of granularity that you may want if you just want to install a single application that you either forgot to install or gets corrupted, as in this case. The tool to do this, Dave,
is something we've mentioned
before.
I've used
it for years.
We are now venturing.
But I'm going to mention it again for the young ones. The young ones.
There you go.
The young ones. Pacifist. What does this tool do for you? Well, it does many things, but the one thing that it does very well is that it allows you to peek into and actually access individual elements of Apple and other installers, more specifically things that are in packages, I think, or you know, well-structured files that are meant to install a bunch of things, but don't necessarily give you the ability to pick which one or ones you would like to pick out of there. And Pacifist will let you peek into, among other things, your OS installer. And so in theory, you could use something like Pacifist to pick out just the Mail app and
right.
Replace it. And then this goes for a lot of things. So if it's an Apple app, you know, like I said, typically Apple doesn't let you reinstall Safari or Safari. Yes. But other parts of the OS that come with it and are installed, it typically doesn't give you the ability to do anything beyond a full OS install. And you may not want to do that for various reasons. Yeah. So love Pacifist, been using it for years. And it also just gives you, just out of curiosity, if you want to see, gee, what are all the pieces that make up OS X? Well, this will tell you because you can see every single one of them using this tool.
Cool.
That's charlessoft.com.
That's right. All right. Let's see. Getting back to what is new or what is uncovered by us anyway. He says, not he, Robert. Well, he, but we'll introduce him. Robert writes, John, you have mentioned Little Snitch a few times and I have recently downloaded it. Interesting network info is displayed. When I logged into Skype, however, I noticed 36 servers listed under Skype, most labeled only by IP address. And when clicking details in Little Snitch, it appears some are connected with Skype by name, but most are not. Many certificates are listed as valid and issued by Apple. Some named Facebook.com, which I do not use. Others were gateway.messenger.live.com. I was prompted to deny or allow each server and denied several, but this quickly became tedious. And I eventually allowed many, not knowing which ones are necessary for Skype and which are not. I follow a trust no one online philosophy, and I am reluctant to use Skype. I hate to go through 36 plus pop-up boxes to check allow or deny every time. What say you guys? Well, I'll kind of give my general overview of Skype here, John, and then I'm curious to hear what you run into because you run Little Snitch. But Skype is interesting. It connects to a lot of servers, and that's just how Skype works. And it's why their network is so robust, because other than when you log in and you validate your credentials with Skype, once you kind of get your authorized token, you're now connecting to lots of different Skype nodes. In fact, it's possible, and I don't think the Mac version does this, but the Windows version, you can run as what's called a super node, and you may not even know that you're running as this, but on your home machine, you might be passing traffic through. It's all encrypted and all of that stuff using Skype's special sauce. But it's what allows them to work very well at getting around, firewalls and routing and all of that stuff. So it just simply works. But it does require it. It's what I call a thick network client as opposed to a thin client. And I mean that in the network sense, as opposed to something like AOL Instant Messenger, right? Or iMessage even, which connects to a single centralized server and lets the server do all the work. Skype connects to lots of different nodes and the Skype application does all the work of pulling things together. And like I said, it keeps it decentralized, which is very, very good for a lot of reasons, but it also means that it needs to open up lots of network connections. This is why the Skype app for iOS is such a battery hog, because it too is a thick network client. It's connecting to the same 36 or more servers out there and keeping all of these connections open simultaneously. So very, very different setup than, like I said, an iMessage or an AOL Instant Messenger. So yes, this is what you will deal with using Skype. It's just how it is. If you want to use Skype in a quote unquote thin way, there is a service called imo.im, and that's the web address that you would type in, imo.im. They have a web client that will allow you to connect to Skype, and it is a thin client. You're making one connection to IMO, and then they are doing the work of connecting to Skype. They also have an iOS app, works great on the iPad or the iPhone, way more efficient because, again, it is a thin client. You're just talking straight, but it's only good on iOS anyway. It's only good for text chats. It's not going to let you do audio or video like the Skype app proper would. So that might be an option for you, especially if you don't want to have to mess with all of Skype's connections. So John, how do you deal with all of Skype's connections and Little Snitch?
Well, like you, Dave, I love Little Snitch.
Well, wait a minute.
No, I would say I am a Little Snitch fan, and I would say that you probably are not.
Yeah, I'm not for exactly the reason that Robert talks about, yes, where he said,
yes, I totally agree.
I get sick of it and I click allow for everything. It's like, okay, well, now it's not doing you any good.
So if there's any downside to a tool like Little Snitch, and what is Little Snitch? And I'll tell you in a nutshell. Little Snitch is something that basically tells you what is trying to go out. So unlike a incoming firewall where you're protecting your computer against the evils that are in the outside world trying to get in, Little Snitch is giving you the opposite functionality. It's telling you things that look suspicious that are trying to get out of your computer and asking for approval. Now, sometimes the only thing, as Robert is pointing out accurately, is that for certain programs, this gets to be a pain in the neck just because of the way they implement TCP/IP. And Skype is one of them, where it has an expectation, once it's running, I have free rein over what ports I want to use to communicate voice data. And so what happens is you will get repeated. And what I do in these cases, Dave, is I tell it at a certain point, it'll come up and say, yeah, Skype is asking to use port 12345. Okay. Skype is asking to use port 23456. Okay. You know what? Just let it use whatever port it wants. Which, now, one could argue it defeats the purpose of a program like Little Snitch, but I don't think it does, because what I do, Dave, is for programs like this, and another one, for example, where you get surprise ports and you never know what they are, is FTP is another protocol.
Yep.
In a lot of cases, that does this, is you never know the port that is going to be selected for using the return data channel. And so you could either sit there and acknowledge all of them and be very paranoid and say, yes, well, I acknowledge all of them, so I know what's going on, or just say, you know what, just do what you want. Now, Little Snitch, in its defense, does offer varying levels of granularity. It'll say, all right, this program on this port, approve that. This program to this port on this server, okay, approve that. So there's different levels, but at some point, yeah, you do have to throw in the towel just because of the way things like Skype work. And it's part of what makes Skype really good or reliable, right, is that it is doing this multi-port. As you said, Dave, I haven't looked into the details of how they implement this, but Supernode, I guess you said, is one concept they have.
Yeah.
Where you're kind of a focal point in the Skype network. For traffic, or I guess you're both receiving and transmitting perhaps other people's traffic, right?
Perhaps. Yeah, that's right. Or at the very least, if you're not transferring their traffic, you're working to get everyone connected. You know, like I said,
provide.
Routing or whatever it is.
Sure.
Yeah. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it's relevant and I'll break our rule. Which we've already broken, but I have someone close to me who works for a very large, Fortune, whatever, low digit company. And we chat on Skype a lot, text, but also audio and video. And this person happened to be in the boardroom of this particular company one day and typed to me and said, answer, but don't say anything. Fine. So Skype rings. I answer. I hear some voices in the background and I get a thing on there and says, a text chat saying, can you hear and can you see me? And I said, yeah. And then, we hung up and text chat comes in. Okay. Yeah. I could see you too. I'm in the boardroom. In theory, our firewalls here at the company are so locked down that nothing should be able to get in and out of this, especially not streaming audio and video. But that's what Skype does, is it doesn't do it to be malicious. It does it to make your life easier, so that when you have a friend, let's say you've got, your family member who's deployed in Afghanistan and you just call. And Skype figures out how to make the call work so that you can see and hear each other. It's just what it does. And so it sure enough routed around this just supposedly very, very locked down corporate firewall. But it was fine. No company secrets were leaked and no one got hurt in the process.
Well, somebody got fired or yelled at.
No,
I'm sure.
No, I don't think anybody even knew.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I'm just wondering if somebody, our system's totally secure. Nobody can get it.
Right. Right.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, Joe. Yeah, hold on here.
It was
you
never
talk to Dave.
Yeah, it was never brought to anyone's attention that this was
right.
doable, because, you know, it's nice to know. But so, yes. Yeah. So
to wrap it up, little snitch is not the best tool for every program. In fact, some programs, it will get annoying, in which case I just punt and I say, you know what, let this program do whatever it wants.
Right.
And you typically set a forever rule for any port that a certain program wants to use. Now, some may argue, well, that's not very secure. Well, I would say, you know, you got to balance, you know, wanting to punch little snitch in the face and and use it, being able to use your computer.
Yeah.
So that's what I do, because it does get it can certainly get in the way. But I still like what it tells me, Dave.
I know.
I would say the thing that I like best about it is, especially when Apple updates the operating system, and it will, and this is the part that tickles me about little snitch and why I still like using it, is that you get an idea of what Apple added to the OS at a low level, because a lot of times once you've done a point upgrade and they've added a new feature, little snitch will come up and say something like, blah, 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 D wants to contact Apple.com. You want to let it? And I'm like, oh, well, that's an interesting new process. I haven't heard of that. Gee, I wonder where that came from. Oh, of course, it came from the last OS update.
Sure.
So it can certainly give you an understanding of what's happening at a lower network level in the OS if you're nosy. But sometimes you just gotta tell it to get out of the way.
That's right. That's right. All right. One last question. Sean writes, and I will read his email verbatim. Okay, you knuckleheads. As I write, I can only open a few applications. The rest bounce for a split second and then disappear. But that's not where the story begins. I've been working on a rather mundane job for the last few weeks, and I decided that in order to alleviate the boredom, I would download a few podcasts to pass the time. And this is where I ran into your show. I have an early 2011 MacBook Pro, 8 gigs of RAM, Mountain Lion, and so on and so forth. I have owned it for a little over a year. I'm a power Windows user, but I'm slowly becoming an OS X convert. I tinker, I dabble, I ignore my wife for hours on end playing with everything from network storage to audio and film editing. Your show has not only helped me to pass the time, but has pointed me in the right direction of all the applications, scripts, and so on, which better my life. And then this happened. Download Secrets, said you. Okay, I said, I'd never heard of it. And so I did, and I played for a while. I tinkered with the settings. If memory served correctly, I turned on all the quartz-related settings and, for some unknown reason, tinkered with the 64-bit kernel, figuring everything was already 64-bit, so what harm could it do? At the same time, I decided it was a good time to streamline my system. I ran monolingual and removed all the necessary language files and architectures. Then it happened. Everything locked up, and upon reboot, I was met with a gray screen of death. I could not get to the login screen. I tried safe boot. I tried command R and fixed permissions. I tried verbose and undid the commands at the terminal the best I could. Nada. Having listened to a handful of your shows, I cursed myself for not having multiple backups of everything. My life was on the MacBook Pro, not backed up at all. I downloaded and reinstalled Mountain Lion, and thankfully it reinstalled, keeping my data intact, which is an amazing feature that should be made clear to Windows users. Finally, I was back in OS X. I went to open iPhoto and it closed without opening. I tried to open the Microsoft suite. Same thing. In fact, everything closed immediately except Safari, Finder, and a few other choice apps. Thinking that this could be a permissions issue, I repaired everything in sight. I also ran DiskWarrior. Same problems. After reinstalling all of my most major apps, I am now back to a nearly normal operating environment and backing up everything as we speak. But the geek in me wants to know why this happened and what might fix it. I still have a few apps that I have not reinstalled for testing purposes. So my questions are, what did I do to break my Mac in the first place? That's number one. Number two, how can one fix the issue of system-wide non-opening apps when they have used all the obvious features such as disk utility? And number three, as a Windows user, after such a fatal crash and recovery, I cannot help but think that some kind of nuke and pave is required to get things running at optimal speed. Should I persevere with getting everything working or backup via Time Machine and start again? Okay. So I want to answer these in a couple orders. Well, I'll answer them actually in order, because this is an interesting thing. His first question, what did I do to break my Mac in the first place? I think the booting issue was the 64-bit kernel and monkeying with that, but I'm placing my bets on monolingual for being the biggest factor in all of the problems that you have. Now, monolingual, for those of you that don't know.
Yes.
Right. It, monolingual is an app and it's a great idea. It will go through and pull out, you know, when you install your operating system, it installs language files for lots of other languages. Well, if you don't use those languages, they're simply taking up space. So it was built to go in and remove those language files. And that actually is relatively fine and relatively safe even. But what it also will do, and I'm assuming that Sean did, is it will go in and it will erase all of the language files inside all of your applications too. And this is where it can get dangerous. And I'm guessing that this is what made all of your apps not work. Now, what's interesting is moving on to step two, you know, how can I fix the issue? Well, you reinstalled the operating system and you said that most apps, iPhoto, Word, Adobe apps still wouldn't open, but some apps would. And the some apps that would were Safari, Finder, I'm guessing Mail, all of the apps that would have come with the OS. Now those apps are back up to what I'm going to call full bloat size. They have all their language files. They have everything. I'm guessing monolingual pulled more out of there than those apps could take. And so by reinstalling the apps first with the OS and then individually with the apps afterwards, and iPhoto, even though it's an Apple app, does not get installed with the OS. You have to install it separately. As you're doing that, you're kind of rebuilding these apps and putting all the stuff back that you had stripped out with monolingual. And I think that's the solution. And so, you know, to question number three, should I punt and reboot? No, I don't think you have to. I think you have, I think you're on to the repair path. So just, you know, if an app won't run, just reinstall it because it's probably just missing some required libraries. But yeah, monolingual, I think was I've always wanted to run monolingual on my system. I never have because it scares me too much that something like this would happen. So what do you think, John?
I'm frightened as well.
Yeah. It's scary, man.
All right. No. Well, issue number one, knuckleheads. Come on.
I think that was a term of endearment, John.
All right. Well, all right, Sean's my favorite knucklehead too. Then
okay. There you go. There you go.
But yeah, digging into the app. So actually, and you can see some of this with almost any app. If you open, if you say open package and you dig around an app, you will see what I'll call localized information, which is at some point you can see it's saying, okay, this is for English. This is for this language. This is for that language. And it's a great feature when you want to customize your apps for different markets, but it's too close, I think, to the app itself in that mucking about with that. So I think you and I, for once here, Dave, I think agree that something like this in theory is a swell idea because you should be able, just as if you looked at a package, you should be able to tell what language resources are probably, that's the thing, probably not necessary for the program to function in your language of choice. But it gets close to other resources that it may accidentally wallop. And I think that's what may have happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's secrets, you know, but some of the other commentary here. So secrets, you know, I got to say, although I love secrets to death, I would say secrets is a lot of unpublished, unsupported stuff in that it may work now. It may not work later. So I would take anything that you do with secrets. I would be. I think Sean realized the error of his ways and that you got to have backups and backups and backups, especially if you're mucking around with the system like this. So secrets is cool, but be warned that whatever they tell you how to do is certainly not supported by the maker of the software.
Right.
It's just like, by the way, you know, somebody at some point found this little trick and, you know, here you can try it yourself. But
yeah, that's right. That's right.
The other thing that occurs to me, Dave, is that if you are removing pieces of an app, the other thing that could happen is that, you know, as we talk about things like Gatekeeper and code signing and stuff like that, you're almost certainly going to screw that up, right?
Actually, yeah. You
especially
know what?
In the age of... go ahead.
No, I was going to say to Sean, before you start, you said you left some apps around for testing reasons. Open up console and try to launch one of those apps that doesn't run and see what's reported there. I wonder if Gatekeeper is the problem, because like you said, you've messed with it. So now the app doesn't, if it does a CRC on itself or whatever, it does not compute. So I wonder if that's what's coming up. And I bet console would show you that. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I got excited by your comment there.
No, that's good. But for those that don't know, Gatekeeper is a new technology that Apple introduced that basically verifies that an app has come from a trusted source. And the one thing is, if you use something like this thing that will remove unnecessary resources, that's all well and good. But then you're almost certainly going to be changing the signature, whatever technology is used to identify the app. So even though you pulled out parts that aren't necessary, the way the app looks to things like Gatekeeper is going to change. And it's going to say, oh, somebody's tampered with this, which they have.
Yeah.
But they haven't done it maliciously for hacking. You've done it to pull out language resources that you don't need. But
that's right.
The one unfortunate offshoot is you're going to upset things like Gatekeeper. So use of this, the use of programs like this that actually monkey with the app, I would say it is, almost certainly going to cause problems like that. So I wonder if he looks in the console, what you were suggesting, it'll come up with a security alert or something saying, whoa, this app has been tampered with.
Yeah.
I'm not launching it.
Yeah.
Though the OS should do that, shouldn't it? I'm thinking.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it is.
Have you tried this? I mean, have you tried modifying an app and then Gatekeeper later on says, something's wrong here.
No, I haven't. Yeah, so I don't know. And Kiwi in the chat room is asking the same question. Does it use the whole package or is there just a piece that Gatekeeper looks at? And I don't know the answer to that. So
I would think for it to be doing what it advertises, it'd be the whole app, right?
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah. All right. So we've got, I want to give us a little bit. We're over an hour already. So I think, So I want to talk a little bit about our power outage preparedness, but I did want to share one quick tip because this came up this week and I learned it. So it's definitely new. If you're on a web page in, I believe this is Mountain Lion, and you click on the share drop down in the little header bar there on the web page in Safari, you can say email this page. And I love doing that. But I hate that it's sending the whole page. I just like to send links to people. And it was pointed out to me that if you do that and then you're in mail and you have a little mail message up, right to the upper right of the content of the mail message, it says, just like it would when you're sending a picture, it's got a little thing there that's relevant to what you're doing. And in this case, it says send web content as, and by default, web page is chosen. Well, you can choose PDF where it'll actually make a PDF of the web page and then send the PDF and the link to the page, or just link only. And then you get the subject of the email is the title of the web page and the content of the email is the link to the web page, which is exactly what I wanted. So you got three options there in your send web content as. And I think that's just awesome because that's how I think. So, John, the last time we talked with everyone here was Sunday, the day before the Hurricane Sandy was supposed to sweep through, and certainly the day before it did sweep through. So we both knew that power outages and other various issues were likely, and so we prepared. And I'm curious how you prepared for this. I've talked a lot about.
I didn't.
Okay. All right. Well, we're old pros at this here in Durham, New Hampshire. So it's.
You are, because it seems at the drop of a hat, you lose power. Your anything you have connected to power.
Yes.
Explodes.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Well, I have a special situation in terms of the lightning here, but Durham in general. Yeah. When we lose power, it stays out for a very long time. So how did you prepare for the storm or how did you prepare? And then how did you deal with your level of preparedness once you were in the thick of it?
Well, I don't think I prepared much at all. If anything, I did. Okay. Now that you mention it.
Yeah.
So one thing that I did is I knew I would need would probably need a computing device. So what I did is, ahead of the storm, I charged up every single freaking battery that I had. So all my computer batteries. So right now I have three batteries for my MacBook Pro. So I have two of the batteries from newer, and I still have an Apple battery, although it keeps, it alerts me when I plug it in saying this battery is shot. It still has a couple of thousand milliamp hours in it.
Okay.
So it's certainly good as a backup. And then for my iPhone, and I got to say, throughout this whole thing, Dave, this taught me the value of having a good smartphone. So, and what I did for the phone, now the phone was, I had more options because in addition to, so I have, a couple of, they're called the Richard Solo 1800, which is a 1800 milliamp hour, external battery pack. And I bought a whole bunch. They had them on special at one point. So I bought a bunch of them. So I have multiple ones of those. In addition to having a battery that will plug into an iDevice, it also has a flashlight. And then the cool part is it has a frickin' laser.
That's so lasers are great.
Yeah. So in order, you know, in addition to charging your devices, you can amuse yourself for hours on end, especially with a laser, or have fun with cats.
Right.
So I had that, but I got to say, Dave, my main link, once the power went out, so my power went out about 7 p.m. Monday, and in an odd twist of fate, I was the one that did not have power for many hours because, and you kind of commented this on Twitter and other avenues, but I was always kind of smug because I'm near various town services, and I thought that my proximity to them would help assure my having power coming back. Well, I think my premise was correct, but the thing is, my understanding of how the electrical grid in my neighborhood works was not.
Yeah, because, I thought that when I moved to New Hampshire, like, oh no, dude, we're near a school. We're don't worry about it. We're fine. Yeah, right.
Yeah, same with me. Is that yes? The houses that were near the police department and the fire department and the other things that are somewhat near to me, they had juice, but I didn't. And actually, the most frustrating point was. So a couple days after the event, things up the street for me, like on my same street, started getting power. I at one point was for many days, I was six houses away from a house that had power.
Oh,
I was like, oh, come on, guys.
That's not good.
You know, UI, you know, I was thinking of, you know, going up to, you know, slipping the UI guy $50 or something. You know, come on. Can you just run it, you know, six more houses down my street?
Yeah,
but no, they had a mess. I actually know some people that know linesmen who were working in the area, and they're like, "Oh, dude, it was just yeah." And I won't even pretend to know about electrical grids. All I know is that you can't just turn the switch on because we had submerged wires and you know trees down. I mean, some of you may have seen some of my photos that I posted. It was so I'd say strategy here. So what I did, okay, charge batteries. Smartphone was pretty much my link. So I didn't have internet.
Right.
But I had phone internet. So I was able to check my email, whatever was plugged in the iDevice. So if anything, one thing that I learned from this, unfortunately, it worked out for me, is if you have a way to give another device access to the things that are important to you, like email, which for me was because a lot of services were actually between the town. They have this thing called... is it Code Red? I think it's called Code Red. It's a service that a lot of towns work with that send out important emails and voicemails to the numbers that you identify. And our town works with them to do that. But, you know, think about it now, having multiple ways to access communication channels that people may want to get in touch with you on.
Yeah.
You know, at first I thought, oh, well, you know, being able to check my email on my iPhone with IMAP is a convenience. Well, in this case, it was almost a necessity to know what was going on because there was no juice, no internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else?
I have a cool stuff found that may have helped you here, John. So I'm going to
go.
I'm going to play this from Kevin.
Hi, Mac Geeks. Kevin here, a proud premium subscriber of the show. I have something really cool for the cool stuff found category that I found, one of the coolest things I've found in a while. It's a battery pack to charge your iPhone, or actually the iPad as well, You can find it on Monoprice. It's a competitor to the Mophie pack, but it's a lot cheaper. So I found this on Monoprice for $28.95 plus shipping, which the shipping was pretty cheap. And so this thing, it's about the size of an iPhone 4. It has 5,000 milliamp, I believe it's milliamp hours. And I did a benchmark on it. I was able to charge my new iPhone 5, right from red up to fully charged 2.5 times. So it's pretty cool. It will, like I said, it will charge the iPad as well. I'm not sure how many times I didn't do a benchmark on that. The other cool thing is that you can charge an iPad and an iPhone at the same time, or anything USB. So it's pretty cool, you know, going around now not having to dim my screen to save battery, or when I'm tethering, taking pictures, all that sort of thing. So in a couple shows ago, you guys were talking about saving battery on the iPhone, and I was kind of chuckling because I no longer have to worry about that. It's kind of cool. I'll send a link in my email to the page, because the best part about this is it was $28.95. So loving the show. Thanks for doing the show, and proud supporter of the show. All right. You can cut me off. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah. And, you know, I looked on Monoprice and I found one. The one he sent in was a 5,000 milliamp hour one with two USB ports. I found one that's a 9,000 milliamp hour one for about $10 more. I think it was $39. It only had one USB port, but obviously, you know, more juice to store. So I thought that, you know, I have a couple of smaller, I think they're about 2,200 milliamp hour chargers that I got from Monoprice when we went on a camping trip a couple of years ago. And they're great. And I keep them, you know, I charge them up before the storm, and it's handy. We run the generator at the house, but it doesn't power much upstairs in the house because we don't really need it. And we don't run it at night when we're asleep, unless it's really cold and we need to keep the heat going. But this time it wasn't. So, I use one of those bricks so that I can charge my iPhone during a power outage at night, and have it right next to my bed. And then I charge up the power brick during the day when the generator's going. So it's time shifted charging, I think is what we would call that. But yeah, we ran the generator and then we didn't have to anymore. So,
it was the roughest I had, Dave.
Oh yeah. That's
karma in a odd twist of fate decided to give you power back almost immediately.
Yeah, I still don't understand
to let me lounge about for almost a week.
Yeah,
without juice. But our area got, oh my gosh! I mean, if you see any pictures hammered of the storms, I mean, I'm in a beach area by the water, and actually, this was the worst storm that I've seen in the short time I've lived here, about 10 years. But the scary part is that I was tracking, and this is where, you may want to think about this now, but what I found also critical was, being tied into. So some people dismiss the Twitters as, you know, it's just people wasting time, but, you know, tweeting things, which I certainly do. But, I was tied into the local power company, so they tweet, the local police, the local state emergency management office, the governor, and between all of them, I was able to know what was happening, including the fact that water almost got from Long Island Sound to my house, and I'm about a mile away from the beach. So this was the worst that I've ever seen, but I was seeing moment by moment. I think it was actually the police were saying, okay, well, the water's reached your street and this street. And I'm like, uh-oh. They're like, okay, now it's reached this street. And I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah.
The good news is that I also knew the tides. And what happened is basically the storm surge went along with the tides. So they were like, so after midnight on Monday is when the tide went out. And fortunately, that was the farthest it got. Gosh, I'm trying to think what else here. Oh, and I learned something very interesting, Dave. Did you know hot water heaters do not need electricity?
Well, it depends. If it's a gas powered, you have natural gas lines, right?
Correct.
So, yes, that's right. You don't need electricity to make your hot, your gas, your natural and gas so powered hot water to work.
So, not that I was, you know, avoiding the hot water, but at one point, yeah. So, after a couple of after day one, everything in the fridge was yuck. So, basically, I washed out things and I was like, you know what? I wonder if I have any hot water. And I was amazed at the fact that I did. And then I'm like, wait, is that either the insulation is really good on this thing or it's actually producing. And then I went downstairs and I'm like, oh yeah. So it has a pilot. So as long as the pilot's on,
yeah,
then yeah, the gas comes in. And of course, as long as you have city water, which I do, right, then you get water pressure. So, and you know, being able to take a hot shower after all the other inconveniences of
it's
living
a big
without
deal.
Power
yeah.
is a good thing to just get you going in the morning. And then also having a gas grill.
Yes.
So I was able to recover a lot of the frozen food because there are certain guidelines. I think typically 24 to 48 hours if they're below 40 degrees and I had a thermometer. But made it through.
Good.
And yeah, the iPhone was my link to civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a good thing. All right, let's wrap this one up. Let's make sure let's tell everybody how to get in touch with us, right? Because we've had all these great questions in this week and we're going to be back here next week. So,
and you thawed out the band.
Yes. Yeah, it's not. Actually, it probably is below freezing outside now. It was 34 when I walked over.
You know, that was the scary part too, is that I think tonight they predicted below freezing. That was the point where I'm like, oh man, if I don't have power when it's freezing, then yeah.
Yeah.
Burst pipes and all that.
Yeah, that's bad.
But Dave, you know, people would like to know how to get in touch with us. And I think one of the best ways, Dave, at least that I've found, well, not personally, because I haven't written into us, though maybe I should, but you probably want to try to send an email to feedback@macgeekapp.com.
Feedback@macgeekapp.com is the email address to use.
And I believe you said feedback.
I did.
MacGeekApp.com.
Unless you happen to fall into the category of Kevin, the same category as Kevin, which is that you are a premium supporter of the show, and then you do get access to our premium at MacGeekApp.com email address that's reserved only for premium supporters, and it's for all of you, and it does get prioritized. So that is one of the perks of helping us do what we do here. We really, really appreciate it, and we're happy to be able to do that in return for you. You can check all that out at MacGeekApp.com/premium. I think we'll get you to a page that explains how all of that works. And we would very much like to have you on board. All right. You can also call us. Anyone can call us. 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. Let's see. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can find us on Twitter. The show is Mac Geek Gab. He's John F. Braun. Pilot Pete is actually in the chat room, but he's not here with us. Mac Observer has all the headlines from TMO, and I'm Dave Hamilton. So that's Twitter. How else are they going to find us, John?
Oh, the Facebooks.
Yes.
Yeah. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab.
Yeah, Facebook's a great place to sign up for the live stream too, because you will get notification if the time changes or anything like that. So definitely check that out. And of course, the live stream is available at MacGeekGab.com/stream. And John, I think that's it. I think it's time to get out of here. We've been here long enough. We want to thank Michael Johnston, of course. We talked about that before, for converting the show to AAC. Thank CashFly, which we talked about before, for all the bandwidth. Everybody in the podcast marketplace. PDF Pen, as we mentioned. Mac, iPad, and iPhone. Gazelle.com for buying all your new, buying all your old iOS and Mac devices. And, of course, BB Edit from Barebones. I'll be back to the media. I was going to say have an outstanding week, folks, but John, go ahead. Why don't you lead us out?
Well, unfortunately, I got to say that during the recent events here, I must say that unfortunately, I think that I may have gotten caught.
Don't do that.
May not.